today on Rockin' the Boat, I'll be joined by John Reese, hydrologist, environmental consultant, photojournalist, and peace activist. Last spring, John Reese traveled to the occupied lands of the West Bank in Israel, occupied by the Israeli army, and is presenting a photo documentary on that visit. He's also the author of numerous articles on the environmental impacts of the Israeli apartheid wall. He'll be joining me by telephone from Seattle, Washington, and he'll be speaking in Santa Cruz this coming weekend. Stand by, stay tuned, Rockin' the Boat, coming straight ahead here on Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. Stay tuned. For some time, the government of Israel has been building a 200-mile, 25-foot-high, so-called security fence around the West Bank of Palestine. Known as the Apartheid Wall to the Palestinian people, the monstrous fence gobbles up about 45,000 acres of land from the West Bank and transfers it to the Israeli side. This figure represents approximately 3% of Palestine's landmass. Construction of the wall will mean the removal of tens of thousands of trees and will affect the hydrology of the area's watersheds. Joining me to discuss the implications of the apartheid wall is John Reese, a Seattle, Washington area activist who was in Palestine for 7 months working with the International Solidarity Movement and the Palestinian Hydrology Group, a nonprofit, non-governmental organization that protects and develops the water resources of Palestine. He collected information on the environmental effects of the illegal Israeli occupation of Palestine and collected data for and helped author the first report on the Israeli apartheid wall put together by the Palestinian Environmental Non-Governmental Organization Network. He also wrote the articles Israel's Apartheid Wall, Environmental Disaster in Palestine, one article, which ran in the EOSTAR 2003 edition of the Earth First Journal. On May 28, 2003, John Reese was denied entry into Israel upon his arrival from Dublin, Ireland. Reese had just completed a multi-month speaking tour of over 50 cities, presenting his slideshow, Palestine, It's Hell, in which he exposed audiences in the U.S. and Ireland to the devastating impacts of the Israeli occupation on the land and the people of Palestine. An extensive photo essay of his two trips to the region can be seen online at www.seattlecan.org. I want to welcome John Reese to Rockin' the Boat. He's joining me by phone. Thanks, John, for being with us tonight.
Yeah, thank you.
Why don't we begin by having you describe your reasons for going to the occupied lands. What compelled you to go there, and what did you hope to accomplish?
Well, mainly I wanted to go there because, as a citizen of the United States, I felt the need to speak out against our policies here. It's the U.S. policies that are promoting the horrendous circumstances in Palestine, the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. It's U.S. money that is supporting the Israeli occupation of the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, and we as Americans, as U.S. citizens, need to speak out against what's going on there. Of course, I wanted to go to see firsthand what was happening. It doesn't take long when you travel through the West Bank and the Gaza Strip to realize that there are atrocities that are being perpetrated on a daily basis there.
You first traveled there last spring in mid-April, is that right, during the invasion of Jenin and Nablus?
Right. I was there for a little over a month in April, most of April, a little bit of May. And then I went back again the end of May, I've forgotten now. Anyway, I was there 6 months again
until
December however backtracking would be for that. But December 20th, I came back to the States, December 19th, rather. So I was there for 7 months all total last year.
Tell me about your first trip there last spring. There were some allegations that the Israeli military committed massacres in the Jenin and Nablus refugee camps. What did you witness on the ground? Can you corroborate these allegations?
Well, I was with the first group of internationals to get in to Jenin after the Israeli army pulled out. And, you know, the numbers that the Israeli general, one of the Israeli generals there first gave, I think he said around 200 Palestinians were killed. I would say that it's closer to that than the 50 that has been put out there. You know, by the different commissions that went in to look at it, international commissions. But, you know, either way, I mean, if you look at even the Boston massacre, it was five people that were killed in the Boston massacre. So even if it was just five, it's still a massacre. There were atrocities that took place there. And we'll never know the numbers, unfortunately, because Israel wouldn't let anybody come in to look and see what was going on there. By the time I got there, you could certainly still smell the dead bodies throughout the camp. But as far as trying to actually dig the bodies up, it was almost impossible. I mean, there was only one piece of heavy equipment there. The world did nothing to assist with what's going on, what happened there.
How were you able to gain access to the region? You said you were among the first internationals in there. How was that made possible?
Well, we attempted to sneak in a couple times, and then finally what we did was just say that we were going to a university nearby there, and some soldiers let us in. It's really kind of the whole security thing in Palestine, the West Bank, Gaza Strip is kind of a joke. Not so much in the Gaza Strip, but in the West Bank for sure. The whole issue that Israel brings up, it's all about security, and that's supposedly what our tax dollars are going for. But it's just it's ridiculous. You can pretty much go where you want. Palestinians can move around if they want to. It's you know, very difficult to do that. But you know, if you want to go somewhere and you're determined, you can pretty much get there. So a lot of times, also the soldiers. Just it's a whim, you know. It depends on what soldier you talk to. Some soldiers don't really give a damn. For instance, one time I got through a checkpoint that was completely closed up because the driver that I had hired for somewhat of an outrageous fee, because since everything was shut down at the time, but I needed to get in. This is going into Ramallah. The driver bribed a soldier for two packs of cigarettes and a bottle of Coke. You know, so. I got in through rode right through the checkpoint when no one else was getting through. So the whole security thing is a joke. Granted, I was an international, but still people can get around. And let me just give you some updates, actually, on the wall, because when I was there, and the first report that we did, second report should come out within about a week. PENGON, Palestinian Environmental NGOs Network, has formed a group called the Apartheid Wall Campaign in Palestine, and we're going to launch a companion campaign here in the States. We're in the process of doing that now to get the word out about the wall. And so we're collecting a lot of more current info about it. Of course, that's an ongoing process. That's something that I did while I was there, and I've been in contact almost at least weekly, getting information, the latest of what's going on. And we've collected new maps from, they're called military orders, and it actually shows now that over half of the West Bank will be closed off to Palestinians. The wall is going to be fencing in about somewhere around 45-47% of Palestine. There will be some enclaves. For instance, there's going to be a fence or a wall, we don't know yet, that will go around Jericho, which is out in the eastern part of Palestine, of the West Bank. But it's taking humongous amounts of land. The 45,000 acres that we estimated was based on just the first phase of the wall.
I see.
And that first phase of the wall is about 72 miles, and it looks like now, again, piecing these maps together, that the actual wall is going to be about 500 miles when you consider all the enclaves.
See, I think that there's a misconception, at least from media reports in this country, that this is just a wall along contiguous borders and that it's not going to be carving into areas that are supposed to be Palestinian-controlled, as you're saying. I'm speaking with John Reese, a Seattle-area activist. He's with the Palestinian Environmental NGO Network, PENGON. He's a hydrologist, environmental consultant, and photojournalist. And we're discussing the what's become known as the Apartheid Wall. You've done extensive research on the water there. As I mentioned, you're a hydrologist. Tell us about what the data shows. How much water do Palestinians currently have access to, and how much will they lose as a result of this wall being put up?
Well, at this time, Palestinians are guaranteed, based on agreements, 17% of the water from the aquifers underneath the West Bank, the mountains of the West Bank. 17% goes to almost 2 million Palestinians, whereas about 83% goes to a little less than 500,000 settlers. Then some of that, a good bit of that water also goes to Israel proper and for irrigation purposes. So Palestinians are already getting definitely short end of the stick there. And in addition to that, this wall, in the first phase only, which will be completed the end of this month, in the first phase alone, that 72-mile area, a strip of wall in the northwest section of the West Bank, when that's completed, there's going to be 36 irrigation wells, and these are the higher production wells in the area. And it's irrigation is extremely important in this area to be able to grow the crops that they need just to survive. And these wells are being taken by Israel. Israel controls all the wells, all the water systems. This is a situation where if you want to have build a well, drill a well, build any type of water structure, you have to get a permit from Israel. If you build anything or deepen a well, without this permit, Israel comes in and destroys that structure. It's the same thing that happened in Rafah when Rachel Corrie was there, who was run over by an Israeli bulldozer. She was one of the tasks that she was working on was trying to save water wells. There are three water wells, in the Rafah area. It's a city in the south part of the Gaza Strip. Bulldozers came in, destroyed two of the three wells, and one of the tasks that Rachel was doing and other ISMers were to were protecting that well. They were doing a 24-hour vigil on the last remaining well. So those are some of the kinds of things that we've been doing over there.
Aren't there these sort of huge buffer zones, too, as a result of this wall, where it's sort of a no-man's land, where they actually put up not one wall, but two walls kind of running parallel to each other, and there's a landmass in between that?
Right. When they come in to build the wall, and in some cases it is a fence, in areas that are not populated, it's a fence, but where there are people, it's a wall. And this is, as you said, about 25 feet high, three stories high almost, and concrete wall, massive structure. And in the process of building this, they shave off an area that can be anywhere from 100 yards wide to 200 yards. So any structure in the path of the wall is completely destroyed. Again, in the first phase of the wall, over 100,000 olive trees have been dug up. And when they dig these trees up, they plant them, they replant them on the Israeli side of the wall. So they've taken 100,000 olive trees from the Palestinians, as well as about 50,000 fruit trees. Same thing, dug them up and then placed them on the other side, and then you would have, it would be on the other side of that buffer. So this buffer is creating a major environmental impact because it's like building a four-lane highway, an interstate highway. They come in and destroy, of course, all the flora and fauna in the building of this, and as well as it's a barrier for any migratory species, and you know there are some deer and migratory species, mm-hmm. So it's having a major environmental impact, and of course the social impact there.
I'm speaking with environmental consultant, photojournalist, and peace activist John Rees of Seattle, Washington. And we're about at the midway point here, John, and I want to kind of maybe move ahead to what's happening currently. Today, four volunteers for the ISM, the group you worked with, were arrested in the Palestinian-occupied territories by the Israeli army near Jenin, protesting the confiscation of Palestinian land for this wall. You were denied entry a few months ago, as I mentioned in the intro. What about the Israeli government's heavy-handed response to the ISM activities there? What can you say about that?
Well, what Israel has been doing, especially through their military, is to block out block the vision of what's happening. Our ISM is the people there are the eyes and ears of the world. In terms of what's going on, because there aren't any human rights workers there for the most part other than ISM. And so if we're going to get the word out about what's going on, we've got to get in and see what's happening. And Israel knows this. They're more afraid of the nonviolent movement of ISMers getting in and seeing what's going on than they are of the suicide bombers. They don't want a nonviolent movement to take place there, and they want to keep internationals out so that they can't see what's going on. Harassment of internationals took place from the time that I was first there and well before that. It's a common occurrence to have your camera smashed and not to be allowed into certain areas, to be told not to take pictures, recorders are taken, anything that will go in, that you can take in, rather, to get the word out, to show that what's happening is often confiscated or are restricted from entering into the areas. So it's certainly, there's a concerted effort to stop any type of data collection from taking place there.
There are those who say that what the ISM and others like you, that what the work you do is sowing the seeds of terror. There's a letter I'd like to draw your attention to, which appeared in a local weekly this week, as a matter of fact. It just came out today. The Metro Santa Cruz printed a letter by a man named Gil Stein, and it's in response to some letters that were written about Rachel Corrie's death. And Gil Stein writes in part about the international solidarity movement, and he quotes, I'll quote from his letter, the ISM website specifically stated that the international solidarity movement, of which Ms. Corrie was a member, supports the armed struggle of the Palestinian people, .. He goes on further in the article to talk about the ISM, and he says on its website that one of the objectives is to interfere with checkpoints. I don't think it is hard to see how the ISM has assisted terrorism. Other examples abound of ISM assistance to Palestinian gunmen. What can you make of these claims? How do you respond to critics like this?
Well, certainly there's a propaganda war going on. I mean, any time you're in this kind of struggle, You want to make your adversary look as bad as possible, and certainly they have the power to do that. The majority of the media is going to. You can look at it every day. It speaks out against Palestinians, calls them terrorists, and of course, so anyone that assists them is going to be called a terrorist. We are a nonviolent movement. What we do say, though, is that we recognize the right of Palestinians to resist. I mean, that's granted by the UN. If you look at UN resolutions, any occupied country has a right to resist its occupiers. But we do promote a nonviolent movement. That's what we're about. If you would call, interfering at a checkpoint, if that means that we take pictures of soldiers beating Palestinians, then yeah, I guess we're interfering. If we're there and as Rachel Corey did, if we stand in front of bulldozers as they're about to smash homes, if that's terrorism, then gee, that's a pretty weird definition of terrorism. We're trying to save lives. We're trying to save the destruction of property. We use no weapons. We use only our bodies.
Another common argument I hear, or question that I hear raised from supporters of the actions of the Israeli military, is the question, why is Israel responsible for all this that you've described with the environmental impacts, that they put the onus on the Palestinians and say, aren't the Palestinians bringing this on themselves by supporting terrorism? How do you respond to that, John Reese?
Well, Palestinians, the majority of Palestinians, and the majority of Israelis even, want an end to the occupation. Numerous polls over the years have indicated this. And the majority of Palestinians do not want their violence to occur. Those that are participating in violent activities are a very small number. The number of incidences that occur per year equate to much less than 0.1% of the population of Palestine. There's about 3.5 million Palestinians, and there's maybe 100 incidences of violence a year. To say that Palestinians are promoting violence, yes, maybe there are some. But what about the Israeli settlers also that have gone in and set bombs off in Palestinian schools? That we don't hear about that, and yet that's even reported in the Haaretz. And Israeli settler terrorist groups claim these activities. 20 Palestinians killed every week, not only by the army, but by Israeli settlers, death squads, both in the army, both army death squads and settler death squads, terrorist groups that go out shooting Palestinians. This is occurring, on a weekly basis. Things that we're not hearing about. I'll admit this. There's violence on each side. We want the violence to stop on both sides. We recognize that there's violence on the Palestinian side. But what's the problem that we have is that no one talks about the Israeli violence.
I have just two more questions. We're about 5 minutes left here, John. You mentioned the media, and you were talking a little bit about that and the Israeli violence. You say that the media doesn't really portray an accurate perception of what's happening on the ground there. You, during your visits, took extensive photographs and have published them on your website, seattlecan.org. What are some of the pictures show? Tell us what the media isn't reporting.
Well, there's a wide range. I have about 1,200 photos on the website. And, I mean, it shows anything from the situation at checkpoints to the destruction of water, pipelines, agricultural fields, the olive trees, as I've mentioned, pictures of olive trees being dug up, the construction of the wall. It shows the movement of soldiers, the tanks in the cities, the destructions of homes, the destruction in cities. It's a lot that we're not seeing. When I was there, you know, certainly I ran into some reporters, but the majority of those reporters would stay around maybe Bethlehem, but usually Jerusalem. And then they write about what they hear from someone else. Very few reporters actually go into the West Bank to see for themselves what's going on. It's very rare that you're going to have anyone from ABC, CBS, NBC, even CNN. I did see CNN on occasion, but it's very rare that you're going to see any of the corporate networks in there to see what's going on.
And then maybe if we could wrap up with your thoughts on the current roadmap, the talks that are happening now. There was a brief ceasefire between some of the so-called extreme terrorist groups and the Israeli military, but that seems to be falling apart. Mr. Mahmoud Abbas doesn't really seem to have strong popular support of the people there. Where do you think this is going?
Well, the roadmap is so general, it doesn't really say much. It doesn't talk about the settlements. You hear about the illegal outposts. This is about 20 outposts where you've had some crazy wingnut settler bring in a trailer, put it on the top of a hill. Some of those settlers have even been kicked out of the existing settlements. You know, they're just they come in and they claim this property. So when they say illegal outpost, they're not even talking about the 139-plus settlements that are throughout the occupied territories that the UN has said they have to go. International law has said they have to go, and yet they continue to be there. The roadmap does not address that. The roadmap does not address water issues or environmental issues. It says we'll talk about them later. The roadmap doesn't even mention the wall. It doesn't talk about the wall whatsoever. It doesn't talk about what property, what land will be Palestinians and what will be for Israelis. So the roadmap has so many holes in it, it's not going to get you anywhere.
And what is your vision in 30 seconds? What is your vision for peace in the region?
Well, I think the first thing that needs to happen is the American public need to start looking into what's going on, educate themselves. There's plenty of web pages. There's Israeli groups that are doing lots of research on what's going on that are against the occupation. We need to stop sending the money to Israel that is being used to commit state terrorism by Israel.
Your website is www.seattlecan.org, seattlecan.org. John Rees, your hydrologist, environmental consultant, photojournalist, peace activist with PENGON, the Palestinian Environmental NGO Network. Your next report, when's that going to be out? Where can folks get a copy?
Well, there will be. We hope that it's going to be finished within the next week or so, and we're going to have a web page up, but if anybody's interested in more info on this, they can email me. It's jreese, J-R-E-E-S-E, at SCN, like Seattle Community Network, .org, and I can get whatever they want to them.
All right, John Rees, I appreciate your time. Thanks for joining me tonight.
Okay, thank you.
And that's going to wrap it up for another edition of Rock in the Boat, each weekday, Monday through Friday, from 5:30 to 6 p.m. right here at Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM, www.freakradio.org. All in all, it was all just